Thankful for your presence this evening. We want to continue our thoughts this evening concerning the question of the meaning of life. Would ask if you take your Bibles out and turn to the book of Ecclesiastes. Chapter number 2 is where we're going to begin tonight in discussing and answering the question according to the wise man Solomon as to the meaning of life. This morning, as we discussed in the beginning of this special series on the book of Ecclesiastes, we talked about Solomon, the wise man who asked for wisdom from God, was granted to him, and all the other things for which he did not ask for in 1 Kings, the 3rd chapter, beginning in verse 7 through verse number 12. We discussed this morning that his understanding of life was that all was vanity, vexation of spirit, and striving after wind. And we began this morning by looking at the repetitious cycle of life. And then we looked at the striving for happiness through human wisdom. And both of those Solomon tried, both of those he understood that leaving God out of that equation did not bring him happiness, but brought him emptiness, loneliness, and did not bring him the things and the meaning of life and the answer to which he so diligently searched for. Tonight, we want to look at probably one of the greatest problems, not only for those in the world, but also for many people who are members of the body of Christ. And that is happiness found in the things that we possess? The emptiness of things. In chapter number 2, Solomon is going to begin in this particular chapter laying out some foundations for things that people have and search for happiness in and the meaning of life. We begin in verse number 1 of chapter number 2, where the Bible says, I said in my heart, come now and I will test you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, but surely this was also vanity. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life. Pleasure. It seems that man can never get their fill, and they are continually looking at ways that satisfying and gratifying the flesh can lead them to ultimate happiness and the true meaning of life. To many in the world, we are here to have a good time. We are here to have all the fun and the frolic and the good times that we can roll into a lifetime. And to many, that is the true meaning of life, to enjoy it to its fullest, to taste of everything that life can offer, and to enjoy it to its fullest extent. For what difference does it make? It's just me. It doesn't hurt anybody else. Many today live for fun and frolic, always in the pursuit of things that will bring them some type of physical attraction or fulfillment of the flesh. Sports, movies, vacations, parties, the list goes on and on. Pleasure and mirth in and of themselves are not sinful. Do not misunderstand what Solomon is saying. That it is not wrong to enjoy pleasures of life. It is not wrong to go to the movies. It is not wrong to go bowling. It is not wrong to do recreational things. It is not wrong to satisfy some of the appetites of the flesh. But what is wrong with all of those things is where life emphasis is placed. If that is all that I'm after, if that is my chief goal, if that is my chief aim, to get anything and everything that satisfies me, that I want to do to please me, if that is my aim and that is my goal, Solomon says, it is empty and it is vanity and it is striving after the wind. Such things are futile and unrewarding according to Solomon. Why? Very simply, they have no lasting nor enduring value. We need to see things for what they are. Solomon was seeking and searching for the happiness that might be produced by the things of this life. Gratifying flesh with wine, what lasting good did that bring in any degree? We can read, as we already studied in the Proverb letter, in chapter 20 and verse 1, chapter 23, verse 29 through 35, a few weeks ago in our Proverbs class, that wine has not brought about any good effects or beneficial effects to man. but yet Solomon tried it. And at the end of the experiment, he found that it brought him nothing but emptiness. Why does man have to learn that answer the hard way? I have seen with my own eyes. I have talked with people in my office who have destroyed themselves with a bottle, who have destroyed their life, who have destroyed anything that was good in life. They threw it away for going after something that was in the bottom of a glass. No, they weren't born with it. They developed it, just like you develop any appetite of the flesh. It is something that we learn to crave. And if that is our aim, if that is our goal, that is the risk that we take. That is the fulfillment of something that brings no pleasure and can bring us no permanent happiness. But you know what? It wasn't just pleasure. Solomon tried all of that, but he tried something else. He tried building projects. He tried to do things. Look at verse number 4 of chapter number 2. What about great accomplishments that we might accomplish in life? I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. Let's stop for a minute. What about Solomon's house? You remember how long it took for him to build it? If we go back to 1 Kings, when the temple was being constructed, it took him 7 years to build the temple. 7 full years of laying the foundation and building all the things that were needed in the temple. But what about Solomon's house? Solomon's house took twice as long to build. It took 13 years. Imagine working on a house for 13 years. It'd have to be some house, or you'd have to have a terrible contractor. 13 years to build a home. If you go back and read 1 Kings chapter, beginning in chapter 4, you're going to see it was very elaborate. It didn't lack for anything. Anything that you could want, anything that could be bought, anything that could be built, Solomon had the means and the money to build it and to get it. And he did. If we continue reading, he said, I planted myself vineyards. I made myself water pools I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions, herds and flocks, than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and special treasures of kings and of provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Now, when you read this list, it is indeed one of great accomplishment. But as we read, I hope you notice the phrase that Solomon kept saying over and over, I made for myself. He did all of these things not for the glory of God, not for the honor of God, not in gratitude to God. He did them for himself. Now, what does that tell us? All these things were done for personal satisfaction. The gardens, terraces to beautify, spectacular landscaping. Nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with spending a lot of money on landscaping your home. There's nothing wrong with putting fruit trees in your backyard. There's nothing wrong with putting a pool in your house or having beautiful landscaping, water pools. Nothing wrong with that. But if that is the sum total of my life, if that's when I'm going to spend my time, my effort, and my money, and I'm going to spend every fiber of my being to have the greatest possession that man could look upon and be the envy of any that saw it, Solomon says it's a waste of time. Solomon says it's vanity and vexation of spirit. It's striving after the wind. Now, my brethren, I want you to take note for a minute. Here's a man that had the ability to do it. Not just talk about it. Not just to be able to think about it and dream about it. Here's a man that was able to do it. Anything that could be built, anything that could be bought, anything that was beautiful, anything that could bring him some personal satisfaction, Solomon had the means at his disposal to do it. And he did it. But in the end, it brought him no enduring happiness and brought him no closer to the question and the answer to the meaning of life. Why do men have to learn that the hard way? We see also in this that he had great irrigation projects. He also had many servants, herds, and flocks. He had possessions that were greater than any one that was before him. Think about all the millions of people that lived before Solomon did. Think about all the millions of people that were living and the kings and the provinces. Think of all the people who were on the earth at that time, and there was not a person that was more wealthier than Solomon. Now, brethren, there's a man that's got means. There's a man that can do everything in life that life has to offer a man. And yet he did it. And he did it looking for some satisfaction. He collected more silver and gold. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines in 1 Kings 11 and verse 3. He had every musical instrument that was known to man. And Solomon excelled in all of these, including in all of his wisdom. It stayed with him. Now, how many advantages did he have? He had a lot more than I've got. And I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say he had a lot more than you have. But you know what? I believe in all of it, it didn't bring him what he wanted most. I want to say that again. In all that he had, in all that he could do, in all that he could build, in all that he could pursue, in all that he could attain and get for his own, it never brought him what he wanted most. And that was, he wanted something that brought him personal satisfaction and led him to the understanding of why he was here. It didn't bring him that. And I'm going to tell you something tonight, brethren. It won't bring us that either. You can have a mansion on a hill on this earth. You can have everything that money can buy. You can be the envy of all your family and all your friends. And you can just live, as we say, in high cotton. But brethren, when it's all said and done, and when your life is over, according to 1 Timothy chapter 6, you didn't bring nothing into this world, and you're taking nothing out. Why would we spend the sum total of our existence gaining things and getting things that are our possessions and working ourselves to death for all the pleasures of this life and the things that we could buy for something that we cannot take with us, and as we're going to see in a moment, could be left to somebody else to just throw to the wind? But you know what? Millions of people are doing it. Millions of people are trying to find this answer that Solomon already told us that there wasn't an answer. He says, I became great and excelled more than anyone who was in Jerusalem before or after. Brethren, why don't we learn by experience? Why do men have to learn lessons that God tried to tell them long, long time ago? Is materialism something new? Is that just something new in the 20th and 21st century? Is that just something that's new that man wants to have everything that he can have and gain all the things that he can possess? Is that just something that's just grown up the last few hundred years? No, we're talking, it's always been around. That man has always pursued to what he wants to satisfy himself. And after he builds it and after he looks at it, it didn't bring him any happiness. You know how I can illustrate this point? I want to use an example. Elvis Presley was a very wealthy man. Elvis Presley also was a very person of great notoriety. Still is some 23 years after his death. And yet, you know what he wanted more than he wanted anything else in life? You know what all the millions of dollars he had, the great home he had down there in Graceland, and all the things he had at his disposal? You know what he wanted more than anything else he wanted in life? He wanted to be able to walk down the street with nobody knowing him like you and me do. Imagine that. He wanted to go unnoticed. He wanted to be able to take his girl to the amusement park without having to buy the whole park out for the whole day, because he couldn't do that like you and me can do that. He couldn't walk down the street and go shopping maybe like we would want to. He couldn't take his daughter to a movie because he couldn't do it. He'd have to rent out the theater because he couldn't do it. Just the simple things that we take as everyday living, he could not do. And he said in a book that I read that he would have traded all every bit of his money to be able to do that. And we thought, and a lot of people thought he was happy. He died a tormented man. He looked for something that he couldn't find in his money, in his riches, and his notoriety. And yet people today are still looking for that pot at the end of the rainbow, never finding it. You know why? Because there's nothing at the end of that rainbow. Because it's temporal. Because it does not last. There's no enduring quality to it. And that's why Solomon wrote this book, to have us to understand that those things will not make us happy. Look at verse number 10. Verse 10 is a very telling verse. John will talk about this Sunday, Wednesday night. Look at verse number 10. Whatever my eye desire, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all of my labor, and this was my reward from all of my labor. I want you to notice that he did not spare himself anything. Anything that he saw, if he couldn't buy it, he built it. If it couldn't be built, he would find someone that could build it for him. If he personally couldn't build it, he'd have it built. If he couldn't build it, then he'd go to have, he'd buy it from somebody who already had it. Anything that he wanted, anything that he saw, anything that he desired, he had the ability to get it. How many of us could say that? I can't say that, can you? But here's a man that had the wealth, the opportunity, the ability, and also had the wisdom to be able to do everything that he could see that he thought could bring him some happiness in life. And he tried all of it. And he said, this was a reward for my labor. You know, God, I want us to understand something. God didn't put us here to be miserable. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't enjoy the things that you work for. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't enjoy the fruit of your labor. Because we're going to see in the Ecclesiastic letter, in chapter 2 and verse 24, chapter 3 and verse 12, chapter 5, verse 18, 8, 15, 9, 9, over and over, Solomon makes the conclusion that we should eat, drink, and enjoy the fruit of our labor. That's right, we should enjoy what we have been blessed with. We should enjoy that which we have worked for, that which we have brought. But should that consume all of my life? No. But can it? Yes. You know, you don't have to be rich to be greedy. Let me say that again. You do not have to be rich to be greedy. You also do not have to be a Solomon to be caught up with materialism. How does it happen? It happens that we want more than we can afford. What we call it, for lack of a better term, is poor stewardship. What the world calls it is credit. If we want it, we go out and buy it. If we can't buy it, we charge it. And we just do anything we can do to somehow, we think, bring us some measure of happiness. Now, again, those things in and of themselves are not wrong. But when that becomes our focus, when that becomes an aim, when that consumes us to where it takes up all of our time away from God, away from family, away from children, something's wrong. Alarm should go off in your head. When you're too busy to enjoy life, your life is running you and you're not running your life. Something is wrong, brethren. Something is wrong. God did never intended our life to run us. God intended us to be in control of our life. And when we put it any other way, we have got problems. Now, I want you to turn your New Testament to 1 Timothy chapter 6. You know what will help you in this? You know what will help me in this? To not be carried away in materialism, to not get carried away with things and possessions, to not get carried away with consuming everything I can get my hands on and try to get everything in life that makes me happy, to understand how much it's worth. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul made this statement, beginning in verse number 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. I heard it said by a preacher many years ago, and I thought it was an excellent illustration. He had yet to see a U-Haul behind a hearse. And I have yet to see that too. I've known people be buried with their money. I know the Egyptians tried that. They tried to build their pyramids and put their servants and all these things. You know why they did it? For the afterlife. You know what? It's still there. And those servants they buried with, and they're dead now. And you know what? You can be buried in your car. You can be buried with your money. And you can be buried with anything that's precious to you, but it will not benefit you in the grave. Because Solomon's going to tell us in a little while that you better, whatever you find to do with your hand, you better do it with all your might, because the grave to where you're going, there is nothing you can do there. And you know what? Whatever I have, when I die, will mean absolutely nothing to me. nothing. Does that mean I should be a pauper? No. But what that means is that I should put things in its proper perspective. Look at the next verse. It says in verse 8, "And having food and clothing, with these shall we be content." What a wonderful word, content. You know what that word content means? Satisfied. That means satisfied. I should be contented. That means I don't have to have a lot to be contented. You know what? You know one of the ways that I remember this story? You know how I learned this lesson in my life? Besides reading the scriptures? My grandfather. You know, my grandfather was a wonderful person. I guess everybody thinks their grandfather's a wonderful person. I did. But you know what I loved about my grandfather most? I thought he did very well in his life. He worked all of his life. He had a farm. He raised five children, did a good job in that. He had a little property that he put up on the side. He worked a full-time job in the city. He did some farming. He worked hard, but he lived to be 89 years old, had a good, rich, and full life. But you know what made my grandfather the most proud? You know what he was the happiest in his life? You know what I remember made him really happy? Is when he had his children around him, when he had his grandchildren around him. That brought him more happiness than anything that he ever built or bought. And you know what? He taught me a lesson very early in my life, what it means to be content with what you have, because you may not have it long. You know, life's a fleeting thing. The Bible goes on to say in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 9, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptations and a snare, and to many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil." And look at the end of that verse. "For which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." I know this is true. I lived in a city where it was built upon this very verse. For the love of money. That's why we have lotteries in 48 of the 50 states. And they will be in all 50 before the next year runs around. We need to understand greed. The love of money is the root of all. Money's not evil. I've heard preachers make the miscalculation that God said money's evil. Money's not evil. That's what we give on the first day of the week to help do the things that we need to do the Lord's work. Money is not evil. The love of money is evil. And you don't have to have a lot of it to love it too much when we hold on to it a little too tight. When we're not willing to share what we've been blessed with. When we keep it so much that we're worried about somebody taking it. When it becomes a chief focus in our life. Brethren, something's wrong. Solomon says that that won't bring you happiness. That will bring you sorrow. And Paul agreed with him in 1 Timothy chapter 6. And you know what? If we're honest with ourselves, we know by experience this is true. Don't we? I'm not telling you anything that you don't know. You know that by what you see and maybe what you've been through yourself. You know what? Solomon forgot. Solomon forgot the words of Moses. I want to read to you what Moses told the second generation prior to going into the land of Canaan. In Deuteronomy, the 17th chapter, and verse 14 through 17, he gave some instruction to those who would be in positions of authority and riches after he was gone. Verse 14 says in the 17th chapter, "When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, 'I will set a king over me like the other nations round about me,' you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your brethren. You shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not, listen, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, 'You shall not return that way again.' Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself." Did Solomon follow that advice? No. He not only multiplied the silver and gold, he also multiplied the wives. And in 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 3, it says those wives turned his heart away from God. He was warned. He did not listen. He had the wisdom to understand, but he didn't put it into practice. Brethren, we need to understand that life does not consist of the abundance of what we have. You know, I didn't say that. That originated with someone else. In Luke chapter 12, in verse 15, Jesus himself said, "Take heed, beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." You know, I know people that this very night that would argue with the Lord about that. But God says it's not the sum total of your life. You know what many of my brethren are going to lose their soul over? A dollar and what it can buy. We don't think that, do we? Because we're not rich like Solomon. But your sum total of your life is not in the things that you possess. And if you don't learn that lesson, you're going to be an unhappy person while you live here on this earth. Because you know what? You will never learn to be satisfied. You will never learn the true meaning of contentment if you don't learn that your life does not consist of the abundance of what you have. The love of money is the root of all evil, and it has destroyed many a family, many a life, and will cost many a soul in eternal torment. And not all of them will be of the world. Some will be my brethren. What was his conclusion? Now, he stated the bad, but what did he think about all that? Go back to Ecclesiastes, look at verse 11 of chapter 2. "Then I looked at all the works that my hands had done, and all the labor which I had toiled. And indeed it was all vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun." You know what Solomon said? "It was a waste of my effort and my time and my being to put my faith and my hope in those material things." Why don't we learn that lesson? You know how you can make sure you learn the lesson? Focus on the eternal, not the temporal. Focus on things that are enduring and last, not on things that are fleeing and passing away. But you know, that's something that the devil has masked very well. He makes it look good. He makes it look enjoyable. He makes it look like it will bring us a lot of happiness. But if that is a... And remember, brethren, don't misunderstand Solomon and don't misunderstand me. Solomon is not saying, God is not saying, that those things are wrong in and of themselves. It's not wrong to have a nice home. It's not wrong to drive a nice car. It's not wrong to wear nice clothes. It's not wrong to do recreational things. But when it is the sum total of your life, when it takes up every moment of your thinking and every moment of your being, where that is the chief aim of what you can get and how quick you can get it, that is vanity. And that will lead you to eternal destruction quicker than any sin that you could commit. Now, we don't like to admit that because we live in a meritistical world where we are, what is our life based on? How do people look at us? How do they judge us? By what we are and what we have. But you know what's sad about that? That's true also with many of my brethren. Materialism, it's a disease, but self-inflicted. It's a self-inflicted disease. And materialism will kill you spiritually. Solomon said it well, and Solomon tried it. And he found out at the end that's what it brought him. Will we do it better? I don't think so. In chapter number 2, he then turns himself to another thing that he knew something about. Wisdom. He next talks about his view of wisdom. And what he's talking about here is earthly wisdom. We must keep things in their context. He's not talking about the wisdom that God gave him. He's talking about human wisdom. In verse number 12, he says, "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done." Whatever the king's going to do that you follow, you're going to do the same thing that he did. And it's not going to change because that comes with the job. The same thing that was done then will be done again. He says in verse 13, "Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness." Now, there's some profit in being wise. I mean, there is some good that can be gained from rather to be serious-minded and to have some wisdom. That's a lot better than to be foolish and to be folly. But in the end, will it matter whichever way it goes? That's his point. There is profit you know, if you have a little wisdom and you use it, it can make your life a lot easier and not as burdensome, and it can make your life tolerable. But if you're foolish and you don't use much common sense, it can make your life a lot tougher. Now, that's true in the physical sense. And Solomon could see that from the physical standpoint. Solomon understands the thoroughness of his personal investigation about wisdom. You know what? I believe he's probably the best qualified on this view to understand the benefit of wisdom because he had so much of it himself. Since everything had already been tried and it hadn't worked, do we need to go through the same disheartening experience again to find out the lessons that Solomon already learned? Man, maybe we need to listen and to heed. Could another king reveal more to us than Solomon did? Could somebody else give us another perspective that Solomon couldn't offer to us? I don't think so. Generally, wisdom does excel folly. Just as true, light is better than darkness. Sometimes. Not all the time. Depends on what you're doing. When I sleep, I don't like the light. I want it to be dark. Makes my sleep better. So it depends on what you're doing. But for a general rule, light is usually better than darkness. And wisdom is better than folly. But can either one of these be our chief aim? That's Solomon's point. Can my chief aim to try to become as wise in this world as I can? If you're the wisest person on the earth and you lose your soul, you weren't as wise as you thought you were. We need to understand something. Look at verse 14 and 15. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. Now, I thought that's an interesting statement. He says the wise, he uses his wisdom. He uses his wisdom in verse 14 there in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. He just goes on aimlessly. But in the end, something happens to them the same. Look at verse 15. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, so it has happened to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this is also vanity. I look at the fool, and I look at the one that's wise, and he used himself as an example, and in the end, the same thing happens to both of them. So how did his wisdom benefit him? Now he goes on to say, as one grows older, you know, as I grow older, I look at things much more differently than I did when I was younger. I look at death much more realistically now than I did 20 years ago. Death, to me, is a very serious matter. I didn't give it too much thought when I was 20. But I'm 46 now, and I give it a lot of thought. And not because I couldn't have died when I was 20, because I could have. But now I understand it because I've got a little bit more experience. And I understand a little bit clearer what God meant when he told me that life is but a vapor that appears for a little while and vanishes away. I understand that a little bit more now than I did then. But you know, we can also read that he is one who carefully cultivates wisdom. Is he going to be exempted from the grave? Nope. I'm going to the grave just like the fool does. If I'm wise, I'm going to go to the grave. If I'm a fool, I'm going to the grave. That's where we're both headed. Now, does that mean I shouldn't worry about being wise? No. That's not the point. That's not Solomon's point. The point is, if my aim is to attain all the earthly wisdom that I can get, how is it going to benefit me in the end any more than the fool? It's not going to benefit me anymore because I'm still going to take it to the grave with me, just like the fool does. Verse 16 says, "For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. Since all that is now will be forgotten in the days to come, how does a wise man die? As the fool. Therefore I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was grievous to me, and all this is vanity and grasping for the wind." How am I any better off at the grave if my chief pursuit was wisdom? I have one doctorate after another. I'm very wise. I'm scholarly. People look up to my wisdom. And here's a fool that has a hard time just balancing his checkbook. But in the end, there's a great level. There's a great level in the end. It's called death. Because in the death, whether you have folly or whether you have wisdom is not going to be the important thing. What's going to be important is what was your chief aim and purpose in life. You know, I've known a lot of people in the eyes of the world that are fools, but were very, very wise men because of the life they live and the focus that they put on the things of this world and on spiritual things. Depends on your perspective, doesn't it? What is Solomon's point? Again, Solomon's point is not, it's not wrong to get an education. It's not wrong to attain wisdom, but don't get too smart for yourself. Because you know what? I've known some men in my life that have just taught themselves literally out of the Bible. They had just become so smart, they become smarter than the Bible. A few years ago, I was talking to a relative, a distant relative, one closer to my father, who at the age of 85, all of a sudden, quit believing in God. Had believed in God all his life, been a faithful Christian, raised up children who were faithful and strong in the church, and all of a sudden at 85, he determined that God wasn't real. He believed that the Bible was not what it claimed to be. And so I was doing the meeting in that area, and I went to talk to him because I grew up with this man. I had a lot of respect for him. And I went there and I talked to him for an hour and a half trying to get him to see what happened. How did you forget everything that you once believed in and how you understood the Bible and all of its truth? And I just tried to reason for, I guess maybe it was 2 hours, we tried to reason. And his son-in-law, who came with us, was sitting on the other side of the sofa, and he looked at me and he looked at his uncle, and he says, "I'll tell you what his problem is. He's got smarter than God." You know, the more I thought about that after I left, the more I wondered if in his mind he did not think that was true, that he got smarter than God. And you know what? It's easy to do. I'm going to tell you a fact tonight. You can take this for what it's worth. In the last 10 years, every departure from the faith that I have seen that has caused trouble among our brethren and has caused to where lines have to be drawn, to where souls are lost, every person that started one of those things had 3 letters behind his name. I do not think that is an accident. When do we become too wise that we overlook the greatest wisdom that is ours for the taking? Can secular wisdom ever take the place of divine wisdom? Never. You know why? Because the one with divine wisdom has all the answers and the questions. We don't. We just got a lot of questions. But God has all of the answers. That makes him in a much better shape than I am. Again, brethren, he's not saying it's wrong to have secular wisdom. It's not wrong to get an education. It's not wrong to get degrees. It's not wrong to be a doctor or something. That's not wrong. But if our focus is to get people to think how smart we are and to pursue that to the extent of the sum total of our life, we are dumber than the fool. Because in the end, we die like the fool. And you know what? Whether you go to heaven or not is not going to be determined by how many degrees you have. Whether you went to college, whether you graduated from high school, I can tell you for a fact, in my life, some of the wisest men I've ever known are people that never stepped foot in a college. Now, that doesn't mean college doesn't have its place. It does. And I believe education is an important thing, but it's not more important than the education that you get from the Bible. There is nothing that takes the place of that. And what Solomon is saying in these verses, if our focus is just to get people to see how smart we can be, then we are no better off than the fool in the world, because the great leveler is death. In death, the fool dies like the wise person. Please take your psalm books out. Turn to page 315. I want to leave you tonight with a statement I want to read. I don't know who authored this, but I believe it's very applicable to what I hear today about human and divine wisdom. This was an example of the world's futility. My journey through darkness has only accelerated. I have become adept at inventing counterfeit lights, bright colored flashing lights, man-made rainbows, artificial sunsets, cellular stars. More recently, I discovered that God is dead. Anyway, I am a product of organic evolution, a cosmic accident, a unique moment in a mysterious 30 billion year process. It is an adventure filled with suspense and cruelty and meaninglessness. And though I do not know what is ahead, never fear, I am on my way. Even today, after reading the morning news and the latest issue of Time magazine, and even though I acknowledge countless gallons of human tears, endless cycles of agonizing tragedy, I, along with the world's majority, maintain Adam made the right decision. Even as I swallow my tranquilizers, rush to my psychiatrist, take the extra drink, endure my third divorce, and watch my children reject all the ideals I tried to pass on to them, I still say that there is hope. End of quote. I say that is not hope. That is living in a dream world. There is only one thing. There is only one answer to true hope. And it doesn't lie in human wisdom. It doesn't lie in anything that you can build or buy. It doesn't lie in the repetitious cycles of life. The only hope that this world has is through Jesus Christ and what he says in his word. There is no other hope that man has. And if man doesn't learn that simple lesson, his life has been vanity, vexation of spirit, striving after wind, and when he hits the grave, he will realize the futility of his life. God says, don't wait till then. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, the reason you're here is to serve God. The reason you were put here is to serve your Maker. The reason you were here to do the best that you can with the abilities that you have to the time that God has allotted you. That's why you're here. That's why I'm here. Solomon sums this all up in a real nutshell at the end of the book. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And I can't make it any simpler than that. If you're not a Christian, you need to become one. If you are a Christian and you have allowed the world's wisdom to take hold of you again and lead you astray from God, you need to come home. You need to repent. You need to pray and ask God to forgive you. You know, the wisest atheist tonight may think he's pretty wise, but when he dies, reality sets in. Why do men have to wait till they hit the grave to find the truth of what Solomon is saying in this book? That's a choice he makes. God allows you to make it. What choice will you make as together we stand and sing?